So I'm Rick Hansen. It's October 4th, 2017. And as you probably know, we've been exploring mindfulness in relationships. Last week, I talked about courage, which has the underlying meaning of heart in terms of the origin of that particular word, which is a really interesting topic to explore, courage, especially interpersonal courage. I've known numerous people who are physically courageous, but socially really contracted and fearful, and not that courageous interpersonally. I've also known people who were courageous interpersonally, and yet were really contracted around and uncomfortable with experiencing their own depths, actually going down deep into the basement of their own psyche because of the creepy crawlers there. So courage is really useful in many ways. It takes courage to do any kind of investigation of yourself, including in spiritual practice, including in Buddhist practice. It takes courage. You don't know what will happen if you are more mindful of your own interior. So courage is a really important topic. It's an interesting topic and not one that's commonly spoken of, I think, in spiritual practice or psychological growth activities of various kinds. Courage. Tonight, I'd like to talk about a topic that's related to courage, which is to say, encouraging. Encouraging others, encouragement, versus discouragement of others and oneself. At first glance, it might seem like a very superficial or small topic, and yet, as I've discovered myself, you know, really reflecting on this and considering it, it opens out in some very, very profound and important things. So to ground the topic of encouragement in a Buddhist frame, one thing that I'm so often struck by is that the story about Buddhism and even our common icons, a statue, I'll actually lift this up, hold it high. Here you have a common image. It's someone with their eyes closed, very internal. Maybe eyes are open, but they're very internal. It's not very relational. It's not very encouraging, in a sense. Okay. And also, though, if you really think about the Dharma, the teachings, they're very encouraging. And they are, in many ways, about encouragement. What do I mean by that? The Buddha encourages us to find the nobility in recognizing suffering. These are called the Four Noble Truths, but recent scholarship suggests they would be better described as the Four Ennobling Truths. It's ennobling in some meaningful way. And again, think about the structure, social structure 2,500 years ago, in which the notion of nobility and being noble, O nobly born, O noble sons and daughters of the Buddha, these are common terms. In a larger context in which the Buddha made his teachings and community accessible to everyone, regardless of birth, regardless of caste, untouchables, householders, with some serious prodding from his mother, opening the doors to women. That's historically true. But which at the time was radical and very controversial as well. So in that larger context, there's an appreciation of inner nobility. That's such an emphasis in Buddhism. It's not about the nobility of birth or circumstance or bank account or standing in society. It's the nobility of inner practice. And so in that context then, he says to us, it's ennobling to actually recognize suffering in yourself and other people. It's ennobling to recognize, to understand and recognize the causes of suffering. It's actually ennobling in the third noble truth to know in your heart the possibility of freedom, the possibility of liberation, of peace, the possibility of love, the possibility of disentangling yourself from the ordinary neurotic patterns of everyday stress and discontent and frustration and irritation and hurt. That's the third noble truth, a very ennobling one. And it's also ennobling to recognize that there's a path. There are things you can do. For whatever may be certainly true about the transcendental and the possibility of grace, this tradition is very much grounded in a focus on one's own personal recognition of what's true, and one's own personal effort. One is not saved by grace in the early teachings of the Buddha. The kind of fourth major development of Buddhism, the Pure Land teachings, talk a lot about the kind of salvatory power, and that's a whole conversation. But certainly, clearly, the original teachings are very much about the fact that there is a path, and without reference to anything metaphysical or supernatural, you actually can take steps every day that will bring you to greater happiness, inner strength, and inner peace. Okay? It's ennobling. Well, it's also really encouraging. It's really encouraging. And when I started reading the reasonably good translations of the early discourses in Buddhism, what really comes through, and I mean this with enormous respect, is the voice of Coach Buddha. Really, saying in various ways, I did these things, you can do them too. There is a relationship between effort and results. These are ways to be more skillful, that's not so skillful. Once in a while, there is the phrase that comes through, which I again relate to as Coach Buddha, oh foolish man. That phrase does come through. I don't know any translations of oh foolish woman, but anyway, comes through that way where someone will come to him with some kind of strange notion, like, you know, if I just stand on my leg, literally, and bark like a dog all day long, will that enlighten me? Buddha says, oh foolish man. You know, and then he goes from there. You can feel it, but it's like a coach who says, no, no, no. If you want to hit the baseball, you have to hold the bat at this end, not the other end, for example, like that. So there's a quality there of encouragement. So it's in that larger context, then, that I want to talk tonight about encouragement and discouragement, encouraging others and encouraging ourselves, sort of in a everyday practical sense. But it's very clear, I think, that if we can appreciate it, there's a very strong quality of encouragement and support. You can do it. Others like you can do it. If you make the efforts, they will indeed bear fruit. And, you know, saying from the teaching, this is a path by design that's good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. That's the encouragement. Now, also in the encouragement is a very strong emphasis on seeing for yourself. It's as if Coach Buddha says, hey, you're hurting where you're at. There are things you can do that will make it better for you. Only you can do that work yourself. And I believe in you, in effect, he says, you can do this and it will make a big difference for you. To me, that's really very encouraging. So in that context, then, I want to give you a couple of examples of encouragement and discouragement. So, for starters, it might be useful to ground this, to think about critical turning points in your own life where someone encouraged you. They might have encouraged you by saying, you don't have to take it anymore. That's encouragement. You don't have to stay there, or you don't have to keep doing that. Or they might have encouraged you by saying, wow, really, you could swim in a bigger pond. You really do have the talent, or you really do have the ability, or you really have the character qualities of drive and virtue, that you really could do that. They might have encouraged you in that way. Or maybe they encouraged you to speak more from your heart, to be more your whole self, your full self. So it might help to think about turning points in your life where people encouraged you or had a general quality even of encouragement. When you were around them, you felt more courageous. You felt heartened rather than disheartened around them. You might also think about people. It is possible to generalize this out to cultures of various kinds. But people in particular who are discouraging, not in a healthy way. I think there's a place for discouraging people from doing certain things. No, I don't think diving into that empty pool is a good idea, right? Or no, I don't think hanging out with that group of people late at night driving home drunk from that party is a really smart thing when you're in high school. Okay, there's a place, I think, for healthy discouragement. But on the whole, think about people who discouraged you, and when you look back, it wasn't that good for you. They rained on your parade. They doubted your dreams. They smallified you. I have a friend who uses the term smallifying or bigifying. Daniel Ellenberg, who teaches here sometimes, guest teaches for me. Okay, so that'll make it kind of more real, right? Encouragement, discouragement. Also notice what it feels like inside to be discouraged. To feel defeated. There's a lot of research on learned helplessness, the acquisition of a sense of futility, defeat, entrapment. And that sense of learned helplessness, which is mammals, we're very, very vulnerable to acquiring very rapidly. That sense of internalized discouragement can become a new kind of habit. We're hardly aware of it. I was actually reflecting here before giving this talk tonight about discouragement for myself and thinking about a particular relationship. And suddenly when I looked at my stance toward that relationship and what I thought I could communicate and what would go well, I realized, looking at it through this lens of encouragement or discouragement, that I'd internalized a sense of prior discouragement. Why bother? It won't work. It'll just make things worse. And that can be internalized in such a way that we kind of take it for granted. We hardly notice it. So it's very useful to actually look inside. Have I acquired discouragement in some regard? Maybe I'm pretty bold, pretty confident, over, pretty willing to just give it a try over here. But over here, I've just internalized an attitude of prior defeat. So it's worth looking at. On the other hand, being aware also of a sense of feeling a kind of internalized encouragement, like feeling encouraged about doing certain kinds of things. Having courage to try things. What's that feel like inside? Okay. So just a kind of a grounding of this in your own experience and things that matter to you will kind of bring it out of the land of TED Talks and into the land of something that really matters to you. Okay. So first example of encouragement has to do with research in developmental psychology, and it's called the visual cliff research, and it opened up a whole category of research related to social support and social referencing. And the actual experiments are very interesting. They bring toddlers who are crawling and a parent into a setup, and they perch the toddler on this surface, which is really thick, solid plexiglass that sits on, underneath it, a painted surface, which then, after about 2 feet, drops down a step. And then after another 2 or 3 feet, drops down another step. So visually, it's like you are crawling out on air, right? And then they see what the kid will do. And they've encouraged the parent to encourage the child to crawl out, and what happens? So it's what they found, amazingly. And then they started varying it, because that's sort of the fundamental paradigm. Depending on temperament, kids vary. Let's say it's a child who's kind of willing to try. Maybe they create a reward over there. Here's the cupcake, or here's the funny little stuffed animal you can have, a little prize. Or maybe there's mom or dad 10 feet away encouraging the child, the toddler, the 15-month-old, the 18-month-old, to give it a try and go out there. So one of the keys is that as the kid approaches, and that now you're walking on air, right? You're crawling on air. Oh. It makes all the difference in the world whether the parent is looking at the child. And they'll manipulate the experiment so they'll have the parent look away, or they'll distract the parent with the experimenter. The experimenter will start asking questions. The child won't go any further. The child stops, generally. On the other hand, if the parent looks at the child in even a fairly neutral way, but with a quality of sustained presence, children tend to keep on going. And especially if the parent is encouraging the child and reassuring and communicating confidence for the child will tend to keep on going. And it's a very powerful finding. It kind of blew the minds of behavioristically oriented original researchers, because they thought it was instinctual in us to avoid falling. because it feels like you're going to fall. The plastic's transparent, essentially. Doesn't look like it's there. And the idea that even for a child who's not verbal particularly, and just the parent smiling and nodding and looking and communicating is still safe, that was highly encouraging. Isn't that kind of really interesting? Okay. Now, a different story about myself, like many of my stories, it's a rock climbing story. And I just want to double check that I'm still going here. Good, good. So many, many years ago, my very good friend Bob, who figures in many of my stories, we were climbing partners and did a lot of stuff together. He's now a professor of medical ethics at Harvard, so it's all turned out all right for him. And I didn't kill him in our adventures, although I tried to. No, not really. So one time, I'll kind of cut to the chase here and tell you the quick story. So imagine that you're in Yosemite Valley, and for those who care, it's on Glacier Point Apron. And so you climb up about 500 feet. So you're roughly 500 feet off the ground already. And then at this particular climb, which was the hardest thing I'd ever led to that point. And if you lead, you go out past your protection. So you just kind of know that. And the way it works is that basically you're going to fall twice as far as you are above your protection, because you're going to fall down to it and then below it until your partner, who's holding the rope tight, you know, the rope catches on that protection. Okay? And we have a lot of powerful instincts not to fall. We don't want to fall. So Bob and I got to this point, and we had sort of thought I would climb it. He had actually climbed a lot in the Yosemite Valley before, and he had done that particular climb. And it, for those who care, it was 5.9, which was originally considered the hardest that humans could climb in the American system. And then people now are climbing up to 5.15. But 5.9 is still really hard. Okay, it was certainly hard for me. So I'm clipped in, and I know I'm in the safety stuff. But this particular climb launches out on a very sheer slab with tiny little holds, like the width of a pencil lead. This you're standing on, you're sticking your fingers on. Maybe a really thick one is like half a pencil. It's okay, you're all seated, remember? You're on your chairs. You will not fall. You are safe, okay? I'm reassuring you, I'm encouraging you. So anyway, and I was nervous. It looked scary. And you just sort of shoot out on a sheer face. And also, we started here sort of on like a ledge, 500 feet up. But as soon as you start on the face from this nice, safe ledge, feels big, suddenly, whoosh, it's like 500 feet straight down. So it's very exposed, very airy. And I could see in the distance, something like 15 feet away, there's a little tiny bolt. They always look really small when you're climbing toward them. And I'm supposed to get up to that. And until I get there, I could fall at the very end, about 30 feet down. I don't like that. So, but all right, there's the bolt. And then another 15, 20 feet past it is this sort of crack area that starts curving up that way. And if I get into the crack area, I know I'll be a little more solid. But this slab, these little tiny holes, the width of half a pencil, that was a nice thick one. Half a pencil width. I felt good on that one. It was a little spooky. So what did Bob do? Did he say there, Rick, you're going to die? He didn't do that. He, in his very warm, doctorly way, was very encouraging. He said things like, I think you can do this. I've really got you. He gave me his complete attention, because as I scooted out, he needed to be aware of the rope so that if I started to fall, he could hold it tight. He's part of my safety system. And he mentioned a few little things. Like he said, yeah, I vaguely remember doing this. That wasn't very helpful. But there was this quality of kind of benign, supportive encouragement. And so I went, okay. Then screwed up my courage, as it were, and started out. And I remember so vividly getting out about 4 feet away from him. I'm on my own visual cliff now, and he's back roughly there. And I look back at him like the toddlers do. You know, got me still. This is freaky, right? And I'm getting way up in front, away from him. And I just kept noticing this feeling of God. He kept looking at me. There was affirmation. You can do it. It wasn't like he was jumping up and down in some loud way, but he was radiating support, radiating faith and a sense of possibility. Well, I'm still here today, so you know I made it. I finally made it, and I kept looking back, and then there was this moment, which is the moment of truth. I could have freaked out and taken a short fall and known that he would catch me, or I could have skittered back. And it was that moment where you launch. And we know that moment in life, don't we? Where we just say, what the heck, in our way or another, and we go for it. We kind of launch. So I got to that point. I remember being there, looking at the bolt that I was going to attach to. That was my next point of protection, that bolt up there. And he just kept looking at me, nodding, you know, yeah, you can do it. And boom, I went for it. And made it. Clipped in the bolt. Whew. I was ethical. I did not put my weight on the bolt. I kept my weight on the rock. Took a few more breaths. I looked back. I think you can do this, Rick. And then he said, I think he even said something like, yeah, you did really well there. You're climbing well, Rick. Okay. Confidence. And then I went to the next section, another 15, 20 feet. I still remember. Boom. Grabbing something. Woo! Safe. Clipped in, kept on going. That's my adventure. That's my story. So there was so much in that story. So I climbed up all the way, another 100 feet or so. He came up. We rappelled down. We eventually made it down. Here's a funny and interesting thing. I said, so Bob, that was so important to me, that you were so encouraging. It was so meaningful. He said, yeah, I was surprised you made it. We were down at the restaurant having a beer, but it was like, what? But that too was really important, because he didn't know. But what was he going to do? You know, shoot out those sort of doubts? Or he knew the risks. You know, I wouldn't die. He knew I was fundamentally safe. Emotionally, it was freaky scary, because it totally goes against your instincts. Ah, fall. But he knew what his job was. I was either going to go for it or not. And if I was going to go for it, in the frame of me going for it, it added zero value for him to dribble his doubts out onto my head. See what I mean? It would have added zero value. What, in that context of the mission, the endeavor, the undertaking, it was really clear what his role was, which was to be encouraging in that way. So I'll give you one more little, I won't. I could tell you another story about Bob. Related, I won't, to my, better not. Okay, good, you got the story so far? So let's unpack that story and think about yourself. And I want to unpack it in terms of a little acronym, ARC, because that's very related to what I did there. There was the arc of the climb, there literally was the arc of the little dihedral that curved back around that I was climbing inside, and ARC. A for acceptance. To truly encourage someone, we've probably all been on the receiving end of kind of generic encouragement. Oh yeah, sure, why not? Other people can, you can. Doesn't feel very real. But if someone meets us right where we are, they meet us with our fears, and they also enter into our world, our priorities. So the encouragement is in relationship to what we really think and what really matters to us. That's critically important for encouragement to have traction. Otherwise, it feels like some kind of sermon or exhortation or go for it, dream your dreams, be like Tony Robbins, walk on fire. And I think Tony Robbins is cool, and I did that firewalk and all that stuff. And he's cool. He meets people, so in my experience. So, but my point is the first aspect of encouragement was to accept, A for accept, in the acronym ARC. What's actually the case in the other person or the case in yourself, including accepting the fears, seeing the real risks, seeing the consequences, meeting the person right where they are. We've probably, again, we've been around people who are trying to influence us, but they're not, they don't do it inside our own frame of reference. They don't enter our world and encourage us from the inside out and the bottom up. And you think about parents with children, me included sometimes, who kind of exhort our kids or prod our kids or tell them they can do it, but it doesn't meet the child. The child doesn't feel met. And maybe the child goes along with it or feels pressured and wants to please the parent or get the parent off their back, but it isn't a full meeting. So to me, it's very important that encouragement have a real meeting. Same with ourselves. If we're going to encourage ourselves to do something, it's really important to tune in and be honest about what's really going on inside. And it's very important. Second thing in the R of the ARC acronym is reassurance. Because often, encouragement is about taking risks. And to reassure someone that the dangers are not so great. Bob must have said at least 5 times during the 10 minutes it took me to launch, maybe 15, from the belay station to where I was hooked into this crack. He must have said 5 times, I've got you, it's safe, there's a triple anchor, he's hooked into a triple anchor. He said, that's a good bolt, Rick. He was reassuring me about anxiety. So reassurance is a very important thing. Or including, it won't be so bad to fail. It won't be horrible. You might look a little silly briefly, but nobody will really care. Reassuring, bounding the threat, bounding the danger in time and space. Reassurance. And I think a lot about how interpersonally important reassurance is. Very often, it's nonverbal. It's a look, it's a nod, it's, I see your capability, it's going to be okay, no tiger's about to pounce, we're all right here. Reassurance is really important. Not false reassurance, like, oh, don't worry about that hurricane, it'll be fine. No, but genuine reassurance that helps people be grounded in reality. And then last, C in ARC, A-R-C, confidence. Communicating faith, confide means confidence, with faith, faith in the other, faith in their capabilities. To see the good and the talent in someone is encouraging, you know, giving them confidence. Bob gave me a lot of confidence that I could go for it. He believed in me. Thank goodness he filtered out his doubts. You know, I didn't need that stuff. At the point I had launched, I was gone. I was going for it, and I needed faith. I needed confidence. And he had confidence in me. He knew I'd be okay no matter what, and he communicated that kind of confidence. So again, how do we communicate? Our confidence in other people, our sense that the odds are good, and also our confidence that even if you don't attain the outcome, intrinsically, it's going to be worth doing. Even if I had totally gone for it and slipped and fallen and gotten a little scraped up, it would have been a bummer. I would have been a little disappointed maybe or irritated. I would have been so glad I had gone for it, no matter what the outcome, rather than, and backing down and backing away, even though I could have gone for it. So confidence that intrinsically it's really worth doing. Including, for example, speaking from your heart. Interpersonal confidence. You know, it's worth saying your truth here and encouraging yourself or encouraging others to do that. Okay. So I think of little gifts to finish my talk part that I'm curious what you feel about this and how it relates to you personally. And think a lot about these little gifts we give others and can give others throughout the day. Someone gave me a very lovely gift at the break, you know, with a little few words to me. That was a gift. And we are given to, and you know how much it matters when people give us these little gifts of encouragement, reassurance, of support, recognition. And in much the same way, we have opportunities throughout the day to be generous ourselves. And to make a little difference many, many, many times away that in addition to touching the hearts and making a difference for the people we communicate with, through them, rippling out in ways known and unknown, seen and unseen, to draw on the words of the Buddha, can also touch the lives and hearts of many other people we don't even know about. The power of those little gifts, those little generosities, those little acts to other people. And encouragement is very, very central among them. Okay. I encourage you to ask your questions or make your comments. What do you think about all that? Yeah.
Rick, your acronym brings to mind something I heard on the radio right after the horrible massacre in Las Vegas. Mm. The announcer on the radio was interviewing a child psychologist about what do parents do to avoid the trauma for the children that are watching this on TV, and what can they do? Mm. And he said the very same thing. Mm. You can't deny that this has happened.
A for accept, yes.
Right.
Awareness, yes.
And you reassure them that no matter what, you will be there to try to protect them from anything like that.
Yeah.
And that your love will remain no matter what. So yeah. I think,
and they can be confident in that. Yeah, that's great.
That.
Oh, thank
very
you.
For yeah. Kids. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Great.
I love so much of what you said, and one of the things that I've been thinking about is, which ties so much into what you said, is just things I've read, and you know, I confess, TED Talks too. But
I love TED Talks. I just, many things get at the end of the day, it's about traction. What are we going to do?
But the two themes that you touched on, or the stuff that you touched on that hit two things that I've been thinking about a lot, is this idea of my parents are at this age where all of a sudden everybody's dying.
Yeah.
And so we were talking a lot about that, and we're talking about how on deathbeds, people don't talk about, you know, I wish I worked another few weeks. They talk about what risks did I not take, and I wish I took.
Yeah.
And this idea of having the encouragement to do that, and how important that is. And then the other theme that I was in a discussion about, which is a TED Talk, is quit early and often, and how we are in a culture where we're taught, you know, quitting is bad.
Yeah.
But if we are going to take risks, we also have to be have permission to decide, you know what, that was a great risk to take, and it's actually not something I want to pursue.
Cutting your losses and moving on, in effect. Yeah.
And so this idea of encouraging yourself, like, I'm going to do this, knowing that if it's not the right job, if it's not the right relationship, if it's not the right ledge to go out on, I'm going to make that decision and turn around without feeling bad about it.
Yeah.
So it's like giving yourself this amount of encouragement to take these risks, knowing that quitting is just, you know, yet another valid decision. It's not a negative thing.
That's great.
So I loved how your discussion, your encouragement kind of supports these things that that I'm kind of pursuing myself.
That is really good. Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Yeah. And yeah.
I was thinking about the opposite, though. So when you are the recipient of someone who tends to unburden their doubts rather than, you know, where they ask you to give heart to them when you need more.
Yes.
How to face that.
It's a huge, huge topic, and I have a few thoughts about that. So just to say it for the recording and for others, what about people who are discouraging and who ask you to encourage them when in fact it's more their role, or at least, hello, fairness, balance time, it's time for them to encourage you, right? A few things about that. First thing is, I think it's helpful to ask yourself, what's the function that is served in various ways by what people do? This is very much a psychologist, therapist way of looking at it, a classic mental health way of looking at it, but it's also a moral way to look at it, in other words, who benefits? Cui bene, that's the Latin phrase. Who benefits? Or more classically, follow the money. Right? Follow the money. At the end of the day, forget all the storyline. Bottom line, what's the function that is served by a person's behavior? What's the function that they're attempting to achieve? And they are often achieving through their words or their deeds or their effects on us. And that's a really, really powerful lens through which to look at things. What is the function that's served? Whether we look at public policy and political statements and behaviors, or whether we look at what's happening in family systems that form a kind of equilibrium, or looking at relationships, or we're looking at things arising in our own mind, like the function that is served by discouraging ourselves before we even launch to that bolt. Maybe that, do you see what I'm saying? It's very useful to ask yourself that thought pattern, that perspective, that inner voice muttering away in the background, what's the function it's serving? And then you work backwards from there. So it could well be that the parents, let's say, or partners or another person's, the function they're trying to serve with their discouragement is well intended on their part. They're trying to protect us from disappointment. They're trying to help us stay safe, in part by staying in a fairly predictable, small world. On the other hand, maybe the function that it serves for them is sort of anticipatory jealousy or envy. They don't want us to get bigger than them. They don't want us to break away from them, to individuate, to become our own woman, our own man, our own person. Maybe that's the function it's serving. So the real question is, what's the function it's serving? Because that really changes the meaning of it and what to do about it. Often there are multiple functions. Freud's term for that was overdetermined. There are multiple factors at work in the minds of other people. But around the second or third time, I mean, for me, the way I am, it's a geeky way of putting it. One time, it's a point. Two times, it defines a line. 3 points define a plane. By the third time someone has done something that kind of pops out for me, I'm sitting back going, aha, a pattern, I suspect. What to do about it, and whether it's changeable, whether they have a learning curve or not, it's a separate question. But seeing fairly quickly, you know, if you get 3 repetitions of a certain kind of behavior, or you get this certain feeling around them that seems very related to how they are, you're not just making it up. It's like, okay, what's the line? Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Not so much shame, but by the third time, in the, to use a metaphor or what have you, the Buddha, in his own night of awakening, I see you, Mara. I see you, forces of delusion, forces of illusion, forces of, if you will, evil. I see you. I recognize you. There's this place for recognition. So that's the first thing. What's the function? The second thing is, for me, is there any information value in it? Is there anything useful here? Like, oh yeah, I really ought to be a little careful about that. Like, my parents were so anxious about money growing up in the Depression, and they gave me so many lectures about saving that in my rebellious, anti-authoritarian, libertarian nature, I pushed away. And then later, as I was halfway through my 50s, I was like, wait, what? You know? So, I mean, maybe there's some information value. You get to decide if there's information value in that discouragement. After that, for me, then it gets into the details of relationships, where the truth is, I just don't want to hear it. If I was 4 feet out on the climb, and Bob started to say to me, you know, Rick, I'm sorry, I have this undelivered communication. I wasn't fully authentic. I should have told you that. I think you probably won't make it. It's really hard. I'd be like, shut up. I'm committed. Leave me alone. Either back my play or get out of the way. You know, to me, and then you find culturally appropriate and relationally appropriate ways to do that. But again, what's the function of your words? Is the function to create an appropriate boundary? To basically say, no, I got it. I heard you the first time. I'll give you another shot. You want to say, can you say anything different or new? Sounds like the same to me. I got it, and this is what I'm going to do. And at the point that this is what I'm going to do, it's not helpful to me that you keep saying these things to me. So for me, it's very important, and you can see that in so many ways. People who express that sort of preemptive strikes of doubt, preemptive doubt strikes. And often people are unsettled by others getting bigger, a little more exuberant, a little more expressed. You start thinking about cultural norms applied to different populations, for example, women. You look at how women are regulated around gesture. Men get to do that all the time. Women do that, it's like, whoa, that's different. A lot of research on that. You know, just to generalize, many exceptions. So you think about, just think about many ways that people communicate kind of preemptive doubt and constriction and inhibition for many reasons, often habitual, but it's not useful, it's not valuable. You know, for me, that's really important. And then the last thing I'll just say about it is, in proportion, in a sense, to the discouragement coming at us from the outside, we need to muster encouragement from the inside to really keep our own counsel, to listen inside ourselves to what's really true. And to, for me, to finish on this point, to give over to our good, to give over to the good that is true inside you, the river of good flowing through you, the river of benefit, of wholesome intention, of good heart, of contribution, of longing to give love, to contribute, to express oneself, to sing, to dance, to play in ways that are real for you, you know, and to give over to that and to be encouraged by it, and to kind of say, particularly if you know that you're willing to quit early and often, if it's not working, but otherwise you're going to give over to that. You're going to bet on your own play. I look back at my life, there are a handful of major mistakes, and one of the major mistakes I would name is that I did not keep faith with myself in my mid-20s. I had a sense of my capabilities, I had a sense of my possibilities, and I did not bet on my own play. I did not back my play. And I kind of recovered later to some extent, but it still would have made made a difference even now today if I had acted differently there. So I think it's important to bet on our own play and to realize we still have a lot of plays at this advanced age, whatever your advanced age may be. It's not too late to make your play in many, many kinds of ways, including in your own personal practice. To really encourage yourself to think, wow, if I were to invest 5 more minutes a day of real practice, maybe dripped out over a day, maybe concentrated in one time, 20 minutes more a day, a little more intensity of application, what would be the results? Can I encourage myself in that way? And can I give over to my inclinations in that regard and let them carry me along as well? That's another aspect of this, to bring it home, to bring it to an end tonight, to be encouraged and to encourage ourselves in whatever is our own personal path of awakening. Okay. How about we sit for a minute and I'm encouraged by your attention. Thank you very much. Hope to see you next week. Be well, keep practicing.
Thanks.